Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
If you can't hear me, please let me know, or feel free to come closer. There's a few closer seats also.
That's good? Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. So I want to start this morning with a brief commercial, if you'll bear with me, for something that I'm going to be doing here every other month for the rest of the year, which is I'm going to be having one-day sittings. And by that, I should say it's maybe a different kind of sitting than people here might be accustomed to. My teacher, who I'm going to talk a little bit about today, his name is Shohaku Okamura, and our style of practice in that lineage is a little bit different, especially in terms of how sesshins work. I don't know, maybe I'll say sesshin is sort of like a intensive meditation retreat, and there's a few different styles. In our style, what we do really is actually just sit all day. we sit 14 50-minute periods of zazen in a day, with 10 minutes of walking in between and just breaks for meals. So that probably sounds maybe a little crazy or scary. But actually, I want to encourage you, if you have any interest, to come and join me to sit. Come even just for one period or two periods if you want to come and see what that's like. The experience of spending the day sitting without making any sound, without speaking any words, without having any of that kind of social interaction, it's really, it's pretty profound and very special, and not the kind of thing that you have access to normally. You know, we spend a lot of time talking and listening, which is good, but it's nice to take a break too. So I encourage you to come sit with me. I think the first one, forgetting the dates, July 11th? Yes. July 11th, and we'll start with orientation the night before. And there's info on the bulletin board out there, too. So, and if you have questions, feel free to ask me afterwards. All right, that's the end of the commercial. Today, I'm going to talk a little bit about one bit of a book that I'm editing. I'm really, really lucky to be editing a book of commentaries by my teacher, Shohaku Okamura. He has really dedicated his entire life to studying Dogen Zenji, studying the teachings and practice of Dogen, and sharing that with everyone. And if that's not a name that means something to you, hang on a sec, because I'm gonna talk about who Dogen was and why I'm talking about him. So I'm gonna set this up a little bit to say that we're gonna head in this talk towards Byakuren, who's the senior Dharma teacher here. Byakuren calls this the existential level of Zen. So I want to set this up a little bit, because it's when you begin to talk about things this way, and you look at your practice this way, and look at your life this way, it can feel a little bit disorienting. It can feel a little bit upside down. Some of the things that I'm going to say. So I'm going to ask you to bear with me on that. I'm going to do my best to sort of set it up, make it clear, But the reality is that what I'm talking about today is not things that are easily, if at all, sort of like dealt with in words, because it's not about words. It's about, I don't know, maybe I'll get to what it's about. I hope I do. Maybe you can tell me what it's about when we're done. But it's definitely something, it's about something that we can't grab onto with our cognition. We can't grab it and manipulate it and use it the way we like to do. With stuff, ideas, or anything else. So, the title of the talk that I gave up here on the top of my piece of paper is Instances of Prajna. That phrase comes from a chapter of Dogen's masterwork, Shobo Genzo. The chapter is called Makahanya Haramitsu. So I know a lot of words. Hold on, I'm going to explain a lot of this stuff. And Makahanya Haramitsu is a commentary on the Heart Sutra. And probably, if you've been around here at all, you probably have come into contact with the Heart Sutra before. But those of you who are new to Buddhism or to this particular sect of Buddhism, Soto Zen Buddhism, there's probably a lot of words in what I just said that don't add up. So I'm gonna take a little bit of this apart and get around to Makahanya Haramitsu and this idea of instances of prajna. First, I want to talk about Dogen. There's a few different names you'll hear for Dogen. You'll hear him called Dogen Zenji. Zenji is an honorific. It basically means like Zen Master Dogen. Or you'll hear him called Eihei Dogen, which was sort of his name as a priest. He also, at some point in his life, went by the name Kigen. Nobody really knows why that was going on, but he did. Dogen was the founder of this sect of Buddhism called Soto Zen Buddhism. He was born in the year 1200 in Japan. He was, by all reports, a very, very brilliant person. He was born into an aristocratic family in Japan. And being a brilliant person and an aristocrat, he had a really, really amazing education. It's said that by the time he was six, he was reading Chinese classics. And then by the time he was seven, actually both his parents had died. And the sort of traditional biography of Dogen says that losing his folks at such a young age awakened in him an awareness of impermanence at a very young age, which seems like a reasonable thing to say. So he went on at how young? Very young. At 13, he was ordained as a Buddhist monk in the Tendai sect of Buddhism in Japan. This Soto Zen Buddhism, this sect of Buddhism did not exist in Japan at that time. It was Dogen brought it back from China. So he was ordained in the Tendai sect. Tendai was huge. It's still huge in Japan. At that time, it was enormous. It's hard to overstate how powerful it was. That sect of Buddhism actually had their own militia. So it was... we have sort of an idealized idea of what it might mean to live in a Buddhist monastery, Mount Hiei, which is where this was not like that. Mount Hiei was a political power and a military power. And if you were an aristocrat like Dogen, and you became a monk at Mount Hiei, your sort of social status came with you. So you had your servants at Mount Hiei in the monastery, just like you had servants outside. So the whole thing didn't really feel great to Dogen, and he didn't like it. And after a few years, he left to study Zen under a teacher named Myo Zen. And this was another kind of Zen that had been brought to Japan earlier called Rinzai Zen. As I said, the kind of Zen we have here is called Soto Zen. There's a lot of terms, I know. Anyway, so he's there. He's practicing Rinzai Zen with his teacher, Myo Zen, at Keninji. And one of the things he's trying to sort out, and this is really important, one of the things he's trying to sort out right from the very beginning is a question that he has, that he carries with him. I found this translation of, I think this is a translation of how he wrote down the question. He wrote, "Both esoteric and exoteric Buddhist teachings say that originally everything is endowed with true Dharma nature, and all living beings are naturally the body of the self nature. If so, why did all the Buddhas in the three times have to arouse Bodhi mind and seek after awakening?" So his question is, if we all have Buddha nature, and what does it say? And we're all originally enlightened, why do we have to practice? Why do we have to show up at 6 in the morning and sit on the cushion? You're already enlightened. He couldn't understand why Buddha had to practice, or why any of this happened. So he went to Myo Zen, practiced Zen with him. Myo Zen didn't have a good answer either, but Myo Zen had a pretty good idea, which was the two of them and a couple other of Myo Zen's disciples went to China to study with Chinese teachers. And at that time, to travel from Japan to China was a big deal. It was a very dangerous journey by sea and expensive. And so they think that Dogen spent all his inheritance on this journey. He went to China, spent everything he had. And he was, at that, this was 12, 20, he was 23 years old at this time when he went to China. It's easy to remember how old Dogen was when stuff happened because he was born in 1200, so the math is really simple. He traveled around China for a couple years. I'm going to make this really simple and try to get through this, but I find it really interesting. I think it's important. Eventually, he met this teacher named Tendo Nyojo, who became his sort of North Star as a teacher and transmitted Soto Zen to him. At the same time that he met Tendo Nyojo, his teacher, Myo Zen, from Japan, died, actually. So Myo Zen didn't come back to Japan with him. But Dogen practiced with Nyojo for 2 years, and then came back to Japan with this new understanding, this sort of new style of, this new style of practice, and went back to Keninji where he had been practicing with Myozen. And this was kind of a problem because they weren't super interested in hearing about his brilliant new ideas, new ideas about practice. So he didn't stay at Keninji very long, but he realized that he was going to need to start his own monastery. Turns out that's also not that easy to do. So that took a few years, and when did he do it? 1233, so 10 years after he had left for China, he establishes his first monastery called Koshoji. And they have a summer practice period there. He writes the first two chapters of this masterwork I mentioned before called Shobo Genzo. The first one is called Genjo Koan, which I'm not going to talk about today, although it's probably the most important piece of Shobo Genzo. And the second one is called Makahanya Haramitsu, which I mentioned before, and that's what we're going to talk about today. There's so much more to say about Dogen, and he's such an interesting person. You should check Dogen out. In fact, you can check him out. I don't know if anyone saw this. There was an article about Dogen on one of the NPR science blogs 2 weeks ago by a philosopher. So you can go look that up. He's really an amazing person. Okay, that's Dogen. I mentioned the Heart Sutra. The Heart Sutra, and I'm going to read a little bit of it to you later. But the Heart Sutra is probably the most important writing in Mahayana Buddhism, Zen Buddhism. It's chanted in Zen temples all over the world every day. We chanted it this morning. It's really short and really hard to understand. And we chant it every day, so that's interesting. But I'm not gonna explain much about the Heart Sutra today because I want to get to Dogen's commentary about it and why. And most importantly, I want to get to why I'm talking about this because I think it's important. Actually, it has something to do with our lives. We have to make a little journey, to get to why this matters. So hang with me. I was also going to just say that I know I like dates. I find the history of things very interesting. The Heart Sutra is sort of an interesting document because although it's super important and we chant it every day, nobody actually knows when it was written or who wrote it or where it came from. There seems to be, in my looking around at books and Googling, there seems to be some consensus around the year 350 CE for its appearance, which means it's pretty old. But also means that's 700 or 800 years after the Buddha died. So I don't know if that's interesting context or not. But so it appeared, but nobody knows how. And the Heart Sutra is a teaching about one of the most difficult things to wrap our brains around in Buddhism. It's a teaching about emptiness. Emptiness is a tricky word for us because emptiness sounds really negative. If I say all beings are empty of self nature. It sounds like, I don't know. It sounds like kind of a bummer, right? I don't know. To me, anyway. That word's tricky. So, I want to explain what we're talking about when we talk about emptiness. Emptiness, instead of being a negative thing, emptiness is an observation about how things actually are. And if we understand what it means, it's actually really liberating. The analogy that my teacher Shahaku always uses about emptiness that I think is really great is he talks about a bubble. He says, if you look in a glass of water, like this one, I don't think there are any bubbles. Well, maybe there is. There actually is one on the bottom. If you look at that, you can see a bubble, and there's no argument. You see a bubble there. Except, what's a bubble? There's water, and there's air inside it. There's air trapped inside water. There's no thing called a bubble. There's air inside water. And when pretty soon that bubble floats over the top and goes boop, then there's still just air and water. There was never any discrete thing we could call a bubble. Except there is, right? Because we can see it. So that's the exact same way, and this is where it gets tricky, that's the exact same way that we are. We are a condition of, okay, we are a condition of five of Buddha taught. We're a condition of five skandhas. There's basically body, and there's five, the five skandhas are body, and then four different things that are basically about your mind. So basically it's a condition of body and mind. That's what you are. This is the teaching. There's not more than that. And that condition changes all the time. And the shape of it changes all the time. Your thinking changes all the time. The shape of your body, the size of it, this condition is in constant flux. There's not another thing that we look at it and say, oh, that's Doan. Does that make sense? Okay. So, everything is like this, according to Buddha's teaching. Me and you and trees and stars and the earth. Everything is like this. And the teaching in the Heart Sutra goes one step further. So the Buddha identifies, he says, the five skandhas. We have form, body, and then we have, feelings, perceptions, impulses, and consciousness. The Heart Sutra goes one step further to say even those five things are empty. Even those five things don't actually exist. So, let me keep going with this. I'm going to read a short bit of the Heart Sutra to you in a minute, and I'm going to read Dogen's commentary on it, and a bit of his commentary about it, and you'll see what it means. Dogen's commentary is focused on the idea of prajna, which is we usually translate prajna as wisdom, but it's not what we always mean by wisdom. This may be starting to seem kind of abstract, possibly. Maybe? But I want to talk about it because I think it's really important in our daily lives, actually, to understand what we are and how we are and how we are in relationship to the universe and to all beings. So, in the paragraph I'm going to read, Dogen says, everything in your life is an instance of prajna. He says, everything in your life is an instance of prajna or wisdom. And you'll see, there's a list of things. That's pretty interesting. Including your body and mind. Instance of prajna. But the Buddha taught us, is everyone here familiar with the Four Noble Truths? Four Noble Truths? Ring a bell? First of the Four Noble Truths is suffering or unsatisfactoriness or something like that. And in the original, earliest teaching of that by the Buddha, he says, actually, your body and your five skandhas are themselves suffering. But Dogen says, your five skandhas are an instance of wisdom. And we're going to see in a minute, the Heart Sutra is going to say your five skandhas are empty. Okay, so let's get to that. I'm going to read the first little bit of the Heart Sutra, then the parallel thing from Dogen's commentary. So I was going to print this out for people, but you're just going to have to listen. I'm sorry. This is the first bit of the Heart Sutra. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, when deeply practicing prajna paramita, clearly saw that all five aggregates, skandhas are empty and thus relieved all suffering. Shariputra, form does not differ from emptiness, emptiness does not differ from form. Form itself is emptiness, emptiness itself form. Sensations, perceptions, formations, and consciousness are also like this. So those are the five skandhas, right? Make sense? Okay. Shariputra, all dharmas are marked by emptiness. They neither arise nor cease, are neither defiled nor pure, neither increase nor decrease. Therefore, given emptiness, there is no form, no sensation, no perception, no formation, no consciousness, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no sight, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch, no object of mind, no realm of sight, no realm of mind consciousness. There is neither ignorance nor extinction of ignorance, neither old age and death, nor extinction of old age and death. No suffering, no cause, no cessation, no path, no knowledge, and no attainment. So, it's pretty hard to understand. It's pretty hard to understand that, I think. But the basic thing, what that basically is a long list of things that basically amounts to everything. Mm-hmm. And whoever wrote this says, everything doesn't exist. Because it's all empty. In spite of, you know, evidence to the contrary like this, this says that doesn't exist. Okay. So, Dogen... Oh, man, there's so many interesting things I want to say about this, but I'm going to skip it. Let me just read this. This is Dogen's commentary. He writes, "The time of Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva practicing profound Prajnaparamita is the whole body clearly seeing the emptiness of all five skandhas. The five skandhas are forms, sensations, perceptions, predilections, and consciousness. This is the fivefold Prajna. Clear seeing is itself Prajna. To unfold and manifest this essential truth, the Heart Sutra states that form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Form is nothing but form. Emptiness is nothing but emptiness. 100 blades of grass, 10,000 things. The 12 sense fields are 12 instances of Prajnaparamita. Also, there are 18 instances of Prajna. Eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, form, sound, smell, taste, touch, objects of mind, as well as the consciousnesses of eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. Also, there are 4 instances of Prajna: suffering, its cause, its cessation, and the path to cessation. Also, there are 6 instances of Prajna: generosity, pure precepts, patience, diligence, meditation, and wisdom. There is also a single instance of Prajna manifesting itself right now: unsurpassable, complete, perfect awakening. Also, there are 3 instances of Prajna: past, present, and future. Also, there are 6 instances of Prajna: earth, water, fire, wind, space, and consciousness. Also, 4 instances of Prajna are going on daily: walking, standing, sitting, and lying down." So, Dogen gives us a pretty long list of things that are Prajna. Do I have a clock here?
Yeah.
I should know what time it is. Cool. Okay, no, good. So, the basic message is that everything is Prajna, but I think that's a pretty abstract idea, so Dogen goes through and tells us a long list of things to kind of show us that. But I'd like to explain what he means by Prajna, because I translated it as wisdom before, and I think that's right. But usually when we talk about wisdom, we're talking about something we have and we use, right? Like, it's like it's like something you possess. Like, we say stuff like, "Oh, that person is wise beyond their years," or "That person made a wise decision," or what else? Like, I had a couple of examples. You know, some people we think, "Oh, that's a wise person," but other people we think, "That's not a wise person." But that clearly is not what Dogen's talking about here, right? Because he says everything has this, everything is this, everything is an instance of this. It's not a kind of thing where if I'm wise, then I can make a good decision. If I'm not wise, I don't make a good decision. It's not like that. So I want to back up to this first sentence from Dogen. Maybe you'll remember it. In it, Dogen tells us that Avalokiteshvara's practice of Prajnaparamita is the whole body seeing the five aggregates, or five skandhas, are empty. And then he tells us the five skandhas themselves are Prajna. So Prajna has something to do with emptiness. So Avalokiteshvara, who, like everything else, everyone else, is made of the five skandhas. So the five skandhas are practicing Prajnaparamita. And the five skandhas practicing Prajnaparamita see that the five skandhas are empty. And therefore, they see that they themselves are Prajna. Does that make sense? Does it? I don't think so. I mean, it kind of does. It kind of does, but that's what the sentence says, right? Avalokiteshvara, we know Avalokiteshvara is five skandhas, sees that the five skandhas are empty, just sees itself. and just sees that itself, if the five skandhas itself are wisdom. Okay, let me try another way through this. So, okay. I gave a talk a couple months ago about the origin of, about this question. Some guy comes to the Buddha and says, why do we always fight with each other? Basically, like, why are we always in conflict with each other? It's a drag. Why do we do it? And the Buddha says, this is interesting, the Buddha says, we come into conflict with each other because of preferences. And then he gives a chain of events that lead to us having preferences. We can see, right? Like, if you didn't have any preferences, we wouldn't ever have any conflicts with each other because you don't care. You know, like, you're not going to have a fight about whether or not you have, like, chicken or tofu for dinner because you don't care. It's all good. Or, you know, there's no conflicts if we don't have preferences. So it's interesting to look and see, how do we get to preferences? So he makes this chain of events. The first event that happens is we have form. There's a form. The form has perception. That perception comes into contact with some object of its senses, right? Like, you have eyes, and I see Diane sitting there, and now there's contact. And then the next step is I make a discrimination. I decide I like it or I don't like it. Oh, there's my friend. I like it. I'm happy. Right? But if I see somebody, like, if you're at work and somebody who's, like, causing you problems, you go like, you veer off down the hallway or something. But, you know, or whatever it is, that's what we do. We make a discrimination, and then that discrimination leads to a desire, like, either I want that thing or I don't want that thing. And that's called preferences. This is how we cause suffering in our lives. This is how we fight with each other and all kinds of stuff. That's what the Buddha teaches in this sort of interesting thing. But Dogen tells us those first few steps right here, where he's talking about perception, he says that's an instance of prajna, that's wisdom. So somehow we have to reconcile. We don't have to reconcile, but somehow we have two pieces here. A piece that says our basic core functions cause us to do things that cause suffering. And also, those same basic ways that we behave as beings are wisdom. So, here's my big question. My big question is, what does this mean? Really, like, what does it mean for my life? Because I feel like it means something. It should. If this is really true about the way I am as a being, I feel like it should... I don't know. I should have some effect in my life. So I'm thinking about that. Everything in the universe, including me, including you, is empty of a self. Everything in the universe is also prajna. So that makes sense grammatically, what I just said. Right? Like, those are words in English that go together and make a sentence. That's cool. But we can get tricked into thinking we get it pretty, because it makes sense as a sentence, when I think if you look more and more closely, it gets more and more disorienting. What does that mean that my body and mind are suffering, they're also empty, and they're also wisdom? I think I need to reevaluate my place in the universe with that information. Or my understanding of where my place is. My usual idea, this is for me, talking about myself. My usual idea, I think, is way too big and way too small. Like, it's too big because I trust and I believe and I take action in my belief in my own self-centered desires and thoughts. Right? Does that make sense? Like, I see myself, and I see my thinking as very important. And in fact, it is. I don't have anything else. But it's a way that I sort of exaggerate what I am as an individual in the universe. But I think also it's too small because I believe that. I'm actually way bigger than that. Not just me. Everybody. if we limit ourselves to this idea of this sort of self-contained five skandhas, we miss something, which is where the sort of, when I said earlier the idea of emptiness is liberating, this is where I think it is that emptiness means enormousness. It means that you and the entire universe is beyond your conception. A couple years ago, I had a dream. I've only remembered maybe like 10 dreams in my life, so for me, it's always really interesting when I remember something from a dream. I woke up from a dream a couple years ago with this phrase in my mind. The phrase was, "You can't imagine your own life." And I really, really like that phrase. Because what it means is, to me, what I think it means is, I can't use this brain to imagine this, right? I can't possibly use my brain to wrap it around what the universe is. It's like my brain is inside it. My brain can't get outside and see. You know, I can't get outside and see the enormousness of what this is. And my brain is important because it's the tool that I have to negotiate the universe, to negotiate in space, so that I don't, you know, get hit by a bus or you know, eat poisonous food or, you know, do some other ridiculous, like, that's my self-preservation mechanism, and it's my way that I get through the world, and my way that I have a lot of amazing experiences. You know, I have beautiful experiences, and I have friends and family and all kinds of great stuff. That stuff comes from my brain. My brain also encourages me, not encourages, because of my brain, I take self-centered action. Because it's the only way this thing can function, is in a sort of a way of self-preservation. And that's what the Buddha's talking about when he says, the five skandhas themselves are suffering. Because it's both at the same time, it's not either or. Like, we live in this world with this body and mind. It's true. And we have suffering, and we come up against problems, and we don't know the best thing to do. And also, your life is enormous. It's unbounded. That I think that's what the emptiness means is that. So the Heart Sutra talks about the five skandhas being empty. Our bodies and minds, our perceptions of the world are all empty. Like I said before, they're based on causes and conditions at a particular time. Our thoughts and feelings are like this. Everything is like this. The sun and the moon. It doesn't mean that we don't exist, but it means that we're not separatable. Separatable? Is that a word? Separable. Thank you. Separable. We're not separable from the rest of the universe. You can't exist as a not in relationship with the rest of the universe. And that's why there's a beautiful teaching from an ancient Chinese teacher named Nanyo Echu, and a student asked him, what's mind? They were having a little debate about teaching about what's the nature of mind. And Nanyo Echu's answer was tiles, pebbles, trees, and grass. I think it's so beautiful, and Dogen later used that image a lot of times. Dogen really liked that teaching. But tiles, pebbles, trees, grass, all of that stuff is mutually supporting each other. That's how we exist. So, all right, I'm almost done, and then I want to hear what you think about this. So Dogen says, not only are they empty, all these things I said, they don't have self-nature. He says they're not only empty, but they are instances of prajna. And I think, like I said, prajna doesn't refer to something that you can own. It isn't like a tool that you can have. It doesn't refer to something you accomplish. It's not something that is associated with us as individuals. It's not a condition of your personal psychology or your thinking. Prajna is the functioning of the universe. There's this great phrase in Buddhism, interdependent co-arising. But I think interdependent co-arising means everything arises together, dependent on everything else. And the interdependent co-arising of all the phenomena in the universe, that's actually, I think, what prajna is. It's every instance of prajna supporting every other instance of prajna. Dogen also has another beautiful phrase. He calls it Zenki in Japanese. And Shohaku translated Zenki as total function. But Katagiri Roshi, I think, maybe I can confirm this, translated Zenki as the whole works. I think it's a great translation for how this works. So I'm gonna stop here with a little apology, because I don't have actually an answer for how understanding this affects your day-to-day life. I think how this affects your day-to-day life, this is the root question of practice. This is the root question of being of being a person, whether you're a Buddhist or not. It's a question of exploring your place in the universe and understanding what that means. So if what the Buddha taught and what Dogen said is true, then what do we do? So thank you. Anybody have any thoughts, questions, comments? Yes, please.
Busy mind, attachments, impermanence. And you put emptiness in there, and then that gives you a bridge to understanding impermanence without the attachments.
Can you say that again?
I
missed the first part.
Our busy mind and our attachments, mm-hmm. and all the things that keep us in delusion and into alternative realities or each other.
Yeah.
And then impermanence.
Yeah.
And emptiness and the concept is a bridge to get us better grounded in impermanence.
Between our busy minds and impermanence. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Cool. I like that. Dee Dee, what do you have to say?
I just thought that the five skandhas viewing themselves as, the household is viewing themselves as empty, to view themselves again, it kind of reminded me of a bit of mindfulness and meditation. It's like you're using your body, the floor, the seats, the cushions, to get to emptiness, to get back to your present body. It just seemed very much similar to what you just said. So.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right on. I think that's really cool. And maybe you notice in this thing, in Dogen's commentary, he says, form is emptiness. The Heart Sutra says, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. And then Dogen says, form is nothing but form. Emptiness is nothing but emptiness. So it's like it keeps turning around, because we can't grab onto it. Yeah.
Once I went into the Science Museum of Minnesota, and I was standing up in a picture of how a child will look at where they are in the universe. You know,
uh-huh.
When you zoom, you know, when you zoom in, and then when you zoom out, how tiny we are, and yet. If you look at the picture, we're a pixel, right? I'm standing here as a human being. I'm a pixel of that. But within that human being, like me, I am just as complex as somebody looking in the universe. I am a jungle of this skandhas that I can barely understand.
Right.
And so the trick to wisdom, I think, is to be in that cusp of understanding, of that child looking at that universe and then the complexity of that person also. It is a trick. It's a hard... And that's what he's trying to say.
Yeah.
This is the thing. If you take everything seriously as permanent, who you are is really a convention.
Yeah.
An agreement or a condition.
Yes.
If the person looking at you say, I don't recognize you, like an Alzheimer's, you don't exist. You literally don't exist. You know, because the observer decides you exist or you don't. And how do you argue that? You can't, you know?
Yeah.
And that's really our condition.
We're
in that cusp of the universe of within this person who's just as complicated.
Yeah. I think of it kind of like peripheral vision, like The one is over here, and the other is over here. And if I let go of trying to focus on stuff, then I can kind of see both things. But it's really hard to hold on to it for very long. Yeah.
So you just say, well, why hold on?
Yeah, exactly.
Let it go.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
I forget the name of the philosopher, but when you were speaking, some things they were referring to, like, it, that concept of, like, the hand, and, like, you're looking at the hand, but the hand's not really a hand. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Kind of that, is that what you're sort of referring to when you say, like, emptiness?
I think so. Well, the hand, there's a hand here. We can see a hand. But also, it's a complicated thing. There's no thing actually called a hand, right? Like, there's skin and muscles and bones and tendons. But then there's not actually anything called those things, because those things are made up of whatever they're made out of. So it deconstructs like that. Another interesting way that this is, though, is we say this is a hand. But actually, there's five fingers here. But it's still a hand, but there's also five fingers. It depends on how we think about it, whether or not this is one hand, whether this is one thing or five things. I think it's like, it is like that. Like, there's a hand here, but we can't find it, actually. The closer we look, we can't find it.
I would be interested in your thoughts about why we chant the Heart Sutra all the time. And because just when you started saying parts of it,
yeah,
you know, I have a certain feeling, or, you know,
yeah,
put you in a certain space.
Yeah.
That's sort of beyond trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
This is the chanting of it.
So why do I think we chant it all the time?
Or not even why, just I think that's part of, I think that's important, that we chant it.
I think often. I think it's really interesting that we chant it so often. I mean,
yeah.
So
I mean, there's a lot of texts we could chant.
Yeah,
and we do chant other texts.
Yeah, but that one always.
Always that one.
So, I mean, one answer is it's short. No, honestly, I mean, I don't know. You know, people are practical, right?
Right.
but I, you know, an interesting thing about the Heart Sutra. One interesting thing about the Heart Sutra. So I read English translation of it. That English translation is from ancient Chinese translation. I don't even know how long it was. That translation is probably done around something like 600 or 700 CE. In Japan, they chant that translation, that ancient Chinese translation. No one understands it. It's true. No. If you go to a Zen monastery in Japan, it's a bunch of monks, and they're chanting the service, the Heart Sutra. You ask them what it says, none of them can tell you. It would be like us chanting, you know, old English, like really old English, or maybe more like old Latin, and then saying, like, what does it mean? No idea. So that's an interesting thing, too, in that Japanese tradition, it's not about understanding the meaning of the text. We like to understand the meaning of the text, so we chant it in English. But we chant it in Japanese, or that Sino, that's ancient Chinese sometimes here too. So I think it's partly about the meaning. I think it's partly ritual. You know, it's a communal activity, using our bodies together to do something. And also, I think the meaning of the text is really, really important. I think this emptiness is It's the crux of things for this, like when I said this existential level of Zen that Byakuran talks about. Emptiness is the crux of it. Because we are so fixated on ourselves, on maintaining our idea of ourselves. You know, I've been thinking about this stuff, like emotional reactions that we have. We really love to get like emotional, get angry. Or we kind of like it, right? Because when you get angry or some other emotion, it reifies you. It's like, it's something, that's you. What are you? I'm angry, or I'm sad, or I'm really happy. We really like to use this stuff to like prove our existence. Or, you know, or whatever else we do, you know, like you have a style of clothes you like to wear because that's me. Or, you know, I don't know. We have a million, a lot of different stuff. Like, you know, I'm up here and like I can show you that I exist because I'm, right now I'm up here as like the guy giving the talk in the robes and like that here I am. It makes me feel safe. It makes me feel uncomfortable to say it doesn't exist. And I think we chant the Heart Sutra every day because we have to be reminded over and over and over and over again to not cling too much to this idea, because when the harder we hold on to this idea of myself as an individual, substantial thing, the more I suffer and the more beings around me suffer. That's what I think. Yes?
I heard a real simple thing about, well, did you get it the first time? Well, then you need to chant it again.
Right.
That makes total sense to me.
Yeah.
I don't even know how to say this question, but I think in Zen I understand that aspect of the absolute and relative and how we put that together really is not a brain thing, and we have to somehow experience it in a different way, and that's why we sit and we quiet and fill it in our hara and know it.
Yep.
Non-intellectually, and it's not about any kind of conception at all, and so on. Yeah, so how do you do that?
Right. with the only tool we have, which is this one. So somehow we have to recognize the inadequacy of this tool, and that it's what we have. That's really important, because that recognizes the possibility that I'm wrong. Or that my idea is incomplete. Or the other people's ideas are complementary to mine and not threatening to mine. Or what, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. So, and it's a body, and that's why we sit, because we use our bodies to sit. We don't use our, when we do practice Zazen, we don't practice Zazen with our brains. We practice with our bodies. Which is why people have heard me rant about how I don't like the word meditation, but I don't like the word meditation. Because it's a body practice. Anyway, yeah. Thank you.
The closing chant is on the front of your bulletin. May our intention equally penetrate